Hey, listeners, it's 2024, and we are so excited for everything ahead this year. If you haven't done so already, make sure to check out our Patreon at patreon.com/curbsiders, where you can get access to bonus episodes. We've already released 18 of them, and they come out twice a month. Plus, you can get access to ad-free episodes and our private Discord server to hang out with other members of the CashLack community. That's patreon.com/curbsiders. Hey, Paul, what do you call a Jedi with anxiety?
Ooh. I don't know.
Panakin Skywalker.
That's maybe my favorite one that you've done.
All right, what do you got?
Matt, I don't know if I ever told you this, but I have anxiety all the time.
Okay.
I'm a walking nervous system.
All right. We say these with love.
The Curbsiders podcast is for entertainment, education, and information purposes only, and the topics discussed should not be used solely to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any diseases or conditions. Furthermore, the views and statements expressed on this podcast are solely those of those and should not be interpreted to reflect official policy or position of any entity, aside from possibly CashLack Memorial Hospital and affiliate outreach programs, if indeed there are any. In fact, there are none. Pretty much, we aren't responsible if you screw up. You should always do your own homework and let us know when we're wrong.
Welcome back to the Curbsiders. I'm Dr. Matthew Watto, here with my great friend and America's primary care physician, Dr. Paul Nelson Williams. Hi, Paul.
Hey, Matt. How are you?
Good. I hope the audience will excuse those puns. As I said, we say those with love. We always like to start the show with a pun. We will be talking about generalized anxiety disorder with a fantastic guest, Dr. Jesse Gold, who is just all over the internet, writing, tweeting, just, all your, I don't know, Paul, she's all over the place. She's very well known.
She's a media mogul. Yeah.
Yes.
I'm starstruck.
In just a second, we will introduce our producer for this episode. But first, could you tell the audience, what is it that we do on Curbsiders?
Sure, Matt. As always, we are the internal medicine podcast. We use expert interviews to bring you clinical pearls and practice-changing knowledge.
And with us today is Edison Eddie Jang. Eddie, it's been a while since you produced a show with us, but you do a lot of our artwork. I'm sure the audience knows your work. They don't know they know your work. How you been, Eddie?
Good, good.
All right. So we had a great guest, Dr. Jesse Gold.
Our guest, Dr. Jesse Gold, is the Chief Wellness Officer of the University of Tennessee and Associate Professor in the Department of Psychiatry at the University of Tennessee Health and Science Center. She writes regularly for the popular press and has been featured, among others, in the New York Times, The Atlantic, and Self. Her first book, How Do You Feel? One Doctor's Search for Humanity in Medicine, will be out in October 2024 from Simon Element. And you can find her at Dr. Jesse Gold across social media platforms.
Okay, and a reminder that this and most episodes will be available for CME credit for all health professionals through VCU Health at curbsiders.vcuhealth.org. And also a reminder, if you want to check out our Patreon, it's patreon.com/curbsiders, where you can get bonus episodes and ad-free episodes, all sorts of other cool stuff. Check it out, patreon.com/curbsiders. Okay, Jesse, we've been talking for a while, but time to bring the audience into this. And thank you so much for coming on the show. The first thing they're going to want to know is, do you have a hobby or interest outside of medicine? And can you share it with us?
I like this question because it implies we have hobbies. I used to have hobbies, and then I went to medical school is how I kind of feel in my life. But, I write a lot, and it started as a hobby and a comfort kind of thing and has evolved as actually part of my job now. So I kind of have to fight the urge to write something for the popular press when I'm writing. And I have to be like, this is for you. And it makes you feel better. You can do that later. It's a whole thing. But that would be my answer, I think.
That's a good one. So you are doing some sort of like journaling or just writing that you're not putting out there into the world. Is that what you're saying?
I had to buy a pen and paper, and I have to do it that way, because otherwise, if I do it on my computer, I go right into trying to make it into something else, and it's not what it's supposed to be for. If something I write like ends up there, that's fine, but it's not comforting and like self-care if you're going right to making it work,
Yeah, probably good to take a break from a screen once in a while as well, so,
I don't know if you know Neil Gaiman. He wrote American Gods and a bunch of other stuff. He's one of my favorite authors, but he now writes his first draft of his books with pen and paper because it forces him, like, this way I can't look up words. I don't go down internet rabbit holes. I'm not interrupted by emails. Like, it's just me and the page, and what happens, happens. And then I always go back and revise it. But his first draft is now all fountain pen handwritten.
I'm just sure to his avoid editors temptation. Hate that.
It's gotta be awful.
And I like my hand, because we don't write that much anymore. Like, even 15, 20 minutes of doing it that way, my hand like cramps. And I'm like, why is this so hard? Not that my hands don't do that for like typing, but it's a whole thing.
No, it sounds romantic, but also awful. And I have enough post-it notes scattered across my office. I'm like, I have no idea what I'm reminding myself at this point now. So I don't think it would go well for me if I tried it.
Paul, anything else you'd like to ask about?
I do like the favorite failure question. So if you have one, and it doesn't have to be a medicine-related failure necessarily, but do you have a failure that you learned something from or at least enjoyed?
All my failures are my favorite failures. You know, like the same way you would say, do I have hobbies? I don't know, but I certainly have failures. I wish we talked about them more. I think for me, I'm a really bad test taker, like standardized tests and like starting young. That was a big failure for me. Like, I threw up in the ACTs and had to cancel my score, which was a whole thing. You know, I started taking it. There were like 5 minutes left or whatever. I got super anxious. I like made it to the end of that and then just like ran out and then canceled my scores immediately because I was like, one, embarrassed, two, like definitely not thinking straight at all. Yeah. But you know, I think it taught me not to put so much pressure on myself ultimately in the long run, but we have tests all the time and it's not like I'm so much better. I'm just a bit better.
Yeah. Tests aren't fun. I hear you. So let's go to our first case from Cashlack. Eddie, do you want to present the case? This is Sophie, right?
Sure. So Sophie is a 24-year-old female, past middle history of depression, obesity, hypothyroidism, who's coming to your clinic with 6 months of increasingly anxious mood. The only medication she's taking right now is levothyroxine. She doesn't smoke or do any other recreational drugs and is just a social drinker. She just moved into town 6 months ago working in a design firm, which has been kind of stressful since her first job. She said she's felt similar anxiety before in college, coupled with some depression, but she's not currently depressed. And she brings some recent blood work in, which shows that her CBC, CMP, and thyroid studies are all within normal range. So for this patient presenting with anxiety, how should we direct the conversation?
This is a good case and a good question. You know, I think the first thing you have to think about, and this is a problem with sort of how we use mental health terminology day to day, is that anxiety is a symptom, not an actual diagnosis every time someone says it. So we use the word so much to mean the symptom sometimes, to mean the diagnosis other times, but people just automatically assume that that's what's going on if people use that word. And it's a lot more complicated than that. So it's like any other medical condition, and you have to go through all the details to figure out what's going on. You have to rule things out. So big thing for me is mental health diagnoses are diagnoses of exclusion, which is as frustrating as it is, I'm sure, for primary care doctors. But, you know, you really are supposed to make sure that nothing else is going on, because it could be a red flag. A lot of medical symptoms present like anxiety. And, you know, we're very quick to be like, young person, stressed person, anxiety. And we just have to make sure, especially, you know, she kind of told you some of them, but in a person who has a thyroid history, I'm glad that she already had labs. That saves you a lot of time. But you do want to like be careful that you don't just make assumptions, you know, whether she had anxiety in the past or not. But, you know, a lot of people who have it in the past will tell me that things get misdiagnosed as anxiety all the time when something else is going on in there. So that's a big thing. But just like anything else, you know, you got to ask like how long things have been going on, what it's like, rule out other symptoms, do a complete review of some systems in both psych and medical. So I think when something is in a psych box, you also have to add all the psych you know, asking really thoroughly about depression. Like she said, she's not depressed, but that's the same thing, right? As saying like, I'm not anxious. Like, what does that really mean? So you want to know about sleep. You want to know what's going on in the whole Siggy Caps kind of thing too.
Do you have a favorite structured questionnaire that you would recommend primary care use? I mean, I know a lot of people use PHQ-9 for depression and the GAD-7 for anxiety, but do you have any others?
You know, those are the most used because they're the shortest and the most studied, you know? So you can technically use the PHQ-2 and the GAD, I think it's 2 or 3 to screen, mm-hmm. but, you know, the PHQ-2 is the first two symptoms of depression, which is like mood, really. Have you been depressed? And the second one being anhedonia. So you're asking that anyway, I'm sure. I think for primary care, it helps in particular to have the questionnaires just because your time is so limited. So I'm a psychiatrist. I still get like an hour intake with people, which is probably like shocking to all of you, but you know that I don't necessarily use the screens unless I'm tracking symptoms over time and really feel like I need it, or if somebody you know, is really bad at clarifying symptoms for themselves in a way that's helpful. But you know, that's probably how I practice, and it's probably not how most people practice, like just because it can be easier to see change and like subtle change when you do that stuff.
Yeah, the questionnaires, tracking them over time, you know, the change in the score for a partial response and that sort of thing. Yeah, I find it helpful for time-wise, and also sometimes patients like don't notice until they like objectively see that their score has changed or hasn't changed. But
I'm Paul, just bad. How are you bad? Okay, great.
Yeah. Yeah, but you're like most of the experts we have on the show, they tend to have internalized a lot of these questionnaires and they don't rely on them the same way a more of a novice primary care would when they're doing them.
Well, I have to ask every question anyway. I have an hour, you know, so if you said, if you like flagged as depression or anxiety, I'm asking you the whole thing anyway. The only difference being sort of like counting the symptoms and asking it in a way to understand frequency, right? So like it has more days than not, less, you know, so really you just want to understand that part. And that's probably the most helpful aspect of that than anything, because all of us have trouble sleeping and concentrating and sometimes feel sad, you know? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. So Eddie, let's go on to the next part of this and dig into it a little more.
Yeah. So you kind of ask about the frequency, character, and severity of some of her symptoms. She states that it's been ongoing for 6 months with anxiety more days in a week than not, occurs at work, at home, and even when she's out with friends. At work, the anxiety revolves around not being competent. At home, she's anxious about her finances and time to do chores. With her friends, she's anxious about being awkward and annoying. When this happens, she feels really restless and tense in her neck and shoulders and hasn't really found a way to control these symptoms. When you ask her if the anxiety is affecting her performance at work and her relationships with her friends, she says that her supervisor says she's been doing excellent work and that her friends have reassured her that she's not awkward or annoying. When the GAD-7 anxiety scale is performed, she scores a 14, moderate anxiety. So does she have an anxiety disorder? Which type, and does it matter much?
I like that she said that she, like, her friends would think she's awkward and annoying. That's just like such a classic way of kind of describing anxiety to other people, you know? But, you know, yes, because of she does have an anxiety disorder, really because of the big things here, which is time frame. So 6 months is generalized anxiety disorder. You know, I always say to patients, like, not everyone makes it to 6 months because it interferes in your life before that. So both of those things are measures of severity. And sometimes people can't wait 6 months to have that. So if you were going to go by strict definition, you might say they don't quite qualify for having generalized anxiety disorder yet, but they just came in earlier because their life was more consumed by it. So it's a little complicated, but you know, in the main things here, like, one, you did an objective screen, so she meets criteria that way, but also really like time frame and severity. And then, you know, if you look at generalized anxiety disorder, it's like time, difficult to control worry, and then a bunch of symptoms, like, and you need three of them. And she has those, you know, I mean, you can ask it. They're all weird symptoms, I think, when you ask people, because they don't really like, are you easily tired? Has your sleep changed? Are you feeling like very keyed up? Like these kind of things like happen to people in stressful workplaces and life a lot. So again, like someone might flag on the symptoms, but not on the timeline or not on the severity. She thinks it's not that big of a deal. You know, like work is not interrupted. Her friends say she's fine. But then if you look at the objective measurement, and in this case, that would have been helpful, you know, like she might not be noticing it as much, or other people might not be noticing it as much, because it's just like an extreme version of her baseline personality. And so people might just be like, well, that's her and that's how she is in the end. So I think that in those cases, the objective measure can be helpful. You also said, does it matter what kind is going on? Super complicated. It's a, you know, in my personal opinion, there are times where it matters and times where it doesn't. You know, at the core, you probably might do the same treatment no matter what. If you go by FDA approvals, which you can in certain circumstances, and you can also understand that to want an FDA approval for panic instead of anxiety, it just means you paid the money for the trial, you know, then you can, you might alter what you're doing in those circumstances. A lot of them are comorbid. So you're going to get somebody who has like generalized anxiety disorder and panic. So that's confusing. I think the big ones for those are like, I think panic you might treat a little differently because someone might need a as needed medicine more than somebody who might be just stressed and anxious all the time. You know, but for the most part, it's helpful to know symptoms. And sometimes the diagnosis matters in those circumstances, but sometimes you're going to do the same thing anyway. So, you know, we used to have like anxiety not otherwise specified, and we just have like unspecified anxiety. Now, a lot of people fit that because of timeline and because of what's going on is not exactly what the DSM said. So, you know, if you're a strict definition person, you would argue very differently than me, I think, but I'm more of like a spectrum, these things overlap person in psychiatry. And those are sort of two camps.
This episode is brought to you by Freed. Freed is an AI scribe that listens, transcribes, and writes medical documentation for you. Gabby, a family medicine physician, and Irez, a computer engineer, came up with Freed, a solution that could help alleviate the daily burden of overworked clinicians everywhere. And for Irez, selfishly, it would mean that he could spend more time with Gabby, who is spending nights, weekends, and holidays updating medical documentation. Freed turns clinicians' daily workflow into accurate documentation instantly. There's no training time, no onboarding, and no extra mental burden. All of the magic happens in just a few clicks, so clinicians can spend less energy on charting and more time on doing what they do best. Today, more than 4,000 clinicians and their spouses have fallen in love with Freed. Freed is an AI scribe that does your medical documentation for you. Charting is critical and necessary, but it steals your focus away from your patients, eats away at your time with your family, and keeps you up at night. The burden of always having another chart to complete drains every clinician. Freed is an AI scribe that makes charting go away. It does your SOAP notes for you. Freed listens, prepares your notes, and writes patients' instructions. Charting is done before your patient walks out of the room. Freed learns your style over time, just like a human scribe, and it will never quit on you. Freed is loved by 4,000 plus clinicians from every specialty. It is HIPAA compliant and it takes 30 seconds to learn. And best of all, Freed costs only $99 per month. You can try Freed for free right now by going to freed.ai. And listeners of Curbsiders can use the code CURB50 for $50 off their first month. This podcast is brought to you by Locum Story. There's a shortage of doctors in America, and locum tenens physicians help alleviate that strain. Did you know that 72% of healthcare facilities are now seeking locum tenens physicians? That's almost double what it was a decade ago. There's a lot to learn about the industry, and that's where Locum Story comes in. They are your source for all things locum tenens. You can find interviews on the Locum Story podcast with experts sharing advice about everything from finances to physician burnout, as well as firsthand stories of providers who have worked temporary locum tenens assignments. They'll get into why they work locums, the experiences they have, and the advice they want to give others looking to try it. You have questions, they have answers, and you can find them by tuning into the Locum Story podcast on Spotify, Apple, or Google Podcasts.
Paul, I think that's more in line with how we roll in this show, right? We're very, very practical. We don't, you know, we don't need to be strictly by the book for like the DSM stuff. I mean, it's just.
I mean, I speak for yourself. But no, and Jesse, I mean, you're kind of touched on this with your answer, but I feel like when patients present with anxiety, it's sometimes you're very lucky and they come and they say, I'm feeling very anxious and here's what's going on. You're like, well, thank you. Like that, you've saved me a lot of time. And other times, as you mentioned, this is part of the differential for a lot of stuff. Or maybe just pick up on something. So you go through the diagnostic criteria and they meet them. And those patients are the ones that kind of struggle explaining what generalized anxiety is and sort of how we think about it. Because to them, it may just, you know, this is stress. This is how life is. You know, this is, you know, this is a normal response to things. So when I know in your field, maybe the patients aren't presenting, maybe the diagnosis has already been semi-made. But I guess, how do you talk to patients about the diagnosis and sort of how it's different than just the stress of life?
So I see a lot of people who've never been diagnosed before. So I see a lot of college kids and I see a lot of healthcare workers. Doesn't mean they haven't been anxious before, but it sure means they avoided coming to get help, right? Mm-hmm. So I think that I'm very used to this conversation and I understand the pushback. I would say, first of all, some of it is cultural. So we describe anxiety symptoms different across cultures. That's complicated. Sometimes you might need to, even when you give something like the GAD-7, that still might be like zero in somebody of a different cultural background. And then you might find out they just call it something else and they're experiencing something else. So I often am like, what does worry mean to you? And like, how does that like present in your life, like mentally and physically? And try to understand it kind of more conceptually than just to be like, are you sleeping? Are you stressed? Are you keyed up? Like, right? Because a lot of people might not understand that. That's a first step. If someone uses the word anxious themselves, I do the same thing, which is reflect it back and say, like, what does anxious mean? because they used it and they must have a concept of it in their head. But then when somebody is actually like, I'm going to say like, so this is what I think is going on. You're right, though, that anxiety is normal, right? So all of us evolve to have anxiety. And I explain it this way because I think it helps people, which is to say, when we were like in the wilderness, anxiety was an indication that there was a threat or there could be a threat. And so our body prepared for that, in part with like sort of what we conceptually think of fight or flight. But if you think about it, if there's a bear, I can't go to sleep. The bear's going to eat me. Or like, if there's a bear, I can't stop thinking about bears because he might come, right? So like all of these symptoms that like we evolved to have are actually like helpful. The problem is our detector gets off, right? So you start seeing threats or predicting threats everywhere. So when all of us might see it when there's like a natural disaster, like these things where like our body's like, oh gosh, that's not good. Somebody who has an anxiety disorder is like firing all the time. And their sort of like ability to detect an actual threat or an actual predicted threat is just off. And so because of that, it makes existing in life challenging because you just see threats everywhere and you're prepared to go, right? Or you think, oh, this is where bears sleep. I know this because I've seen a bear in a place like this and I need to keep looking for the bear, right? Like I'm just using bear as a weird example, but it's probably like dinosaurs, right? So, but I think, you know, I explain it from an evolutionary perspective a lot because all of the symptoms make sense within that perspective. And just to say, you're just kind of like, your triggers too fast. Like it just comes on too quickly for you. The degree to get you to there is too low. So people like, you know, you're seeing it all the time. And what we want to do is get you back to, you know, this state where it's helpful and not a state where it's like in your way and making it so you can't do the things you want to do.
So what sort of self-directed activities would you talk to someone like Sophie about? Because it's in primary care, before they get to see someone like you that can, you know, really has a lot of knowledge and can help them with this, they're going to be with primary care. Maybe it'll take them a while to get in with a therapist, a psychiatrist, or if they start medicine, it takes a while to work. So like, what can they do in the meantime?
you also don't have enough time to do a lot of things. So mm-hmm. you're not giving yourself credit for that. But I think that there's just the time pressure to really do like some kind of effective intervention is just not fair for you mm-hmm. guys. You asked about hobbies in the beginning, and I think that is a really helpful way of conceptualizing what I tell people. So I think coping skills, this is a personal opinion, should be viewed as hobbies instead of prescriptions. So there's evidence on mindfulness. There's evidence on meditation. There's evidence on journaling. But if you hate journaling, you're not going to do it. If you hate mindfulness, you're going to be like me and like lose your actual mind in those settings, right? So you have to pick something you're going to do. That might mean like a hobby, you try out some stuff. So that might mean you say like, hey, here's some stuff that patients have liked. Mindfulness, journaling, whatever you know and can explain quickly. And then you say, or even something you've like enjoyed and liked. And then you say, but the thing is, these things are not a prescription and it only matters if you do it. What is self-care to you is what you will do, right? So it's important that even if these things have evidence that you're doing the one that you actually like and that's comforting to you. The cool thing is there are a lot of things to choose from. You know, there's this whole like pleasant activities list, which can seem cheesy, but in a lot of ways you can hand it out to people and it's just like things that people do that they enjoy, right? So sometimes when you're anxious and sometimes when you're sad, you can't get there. Like, it's just like, I have too much. It's like a menu, choosing where to go to dinner and there, or like looking at one of those really big menus and you're just like, I can't do anything. And you kind of freeze. And so that sort of is like helping you guide the menu. So that can be pretty easy. You know, I also like keep a stress ball on my desk. I keep stress putty on my desk. I think those things can be really helpful for people if they start playing around with it, especially if like the stress is coming from something like work and like you can't see my hands unless I go like this on Zoom, right? So I've played with stress putty while talking to patients before because you can't see it. And I think that's helpful. You know, apps are mixed. I have no problem with people using them. I think there are some good ones. I would not expect you to like memorize which apps are good. But if you've used one or a patient's used one, having a list of them can be helpful to just be like, these are quick. You download them. You can play on them. It's your call, right? But I think the caveat on apps is like they're not a replacement for therapy, but also some of them can be shady and steal your data and stuff like that, just like any app. So you just have to be aware that like, just because they're for mental health does not mean they're perfect. But, you know, I think a lot of, you know, Headspace and Calm are good apps. The free versions are good. If you're not a person who likes that stuff, like Calm has bedtime stories. They just read you stories before you go to bed, like famous people. Sometimes people like that instead of like a meditation that just doesn't resonate. You know, having you guys like actually work through like what thoughts are coming up and what was going on at that time and how are you feeling is like too big of a thing to try to tackle in 15 minutes. Like, you're basically explaining how cognitive behavioral therapy works, you know, in like a second, because that's like the basis of it. And I think that also wouldn't work on everyone. And I would only probably recommend something like that if it was super clear that if that person listened to the things they were saying to me, it would make a difference. And I might say, jot down your thoughts when you notice you're anxious and see that what happens, but don't obsess over it. So the other thing with people with anxiety is if you give them a skill or you give them a way to track their mental health, sometimes they obsess over it because they become like, this is what I'm supposed to do. The doctor said I had to do it, whatever. And, you know, mood apps and tracking, totally helpful once a week or something. I don't know if something changes, right? But if you use like a Fitbit or, you know, like an Apple Watch and it tells you you slept like 0.1 less, like what does that mean? Like, does it mean anything? And I can't tell you the number of people who will be like, I have sleeping. I mean, sure, it happens to you too. Like, I have a sleeping problem because my watch said so. And you're like, well, are you sleeping? You know? And so I think it's just like with these things, you have to do what's easy for you guys. I don't expect you to know everything. Pointing them towards useful resources, even if it's like NAMI or some of these like organizations that have been around and collect resources on their own, like you're able to do stuff like that pretty easily, I think. You know, if you make a handout that you just give to everyone with anxiety that has like a list of apps, a list, the pleasant activities thing, you know, and you're like, I realize this is information overload, but like read it and play around with it and see what you like. And next time you come back, we'll talk about it, right? Like you're not a therapist.
What does NAMI stand for?
So it stands for National Alliance on Mental Illness. So it's like just a very big organization that really their purpose is to educate like patients and families. And so that can be really helpful as a place to find information and find what works for people. They even have like peer supporters and stuff like that. So if you had a new diagnosis of something like schizophrenia and your family or yourself wanted help around that, they have trained people who can help you. So it's definitely a good, and there's chapters in every state and a lot of cities and stuff. So it's a good place to start if you're just like, it's a good organization, I swear, right? Like you just, it, sometimes you don't want to point people towards these like big overbearing organizations and they just have tons of stuff and the website itself is like an anxiety stressor.
Paul, you were going to say something.
Oh, was I? Oh, I was just thinking about the patients who are so good at tracking their symptoms and are so good. Like I'm just, Matt, you've had the patient who has prediabetes who checks their sugar 14 times a day and they have like the Excel spreadsheet and you're like, this is almost too much self-efficacy. Like I appreciate what you're trying to do, but I guess my question for you, we'll talk about medications, I think at length, but what kind of calculus, can you just talk us through sort of what you're thinking about and how you decide whether or not to offer medication versus a lot of this sort of other supportive stuff at the initial visit? So for the person who's presenting to you for the first time, what factors play into the decision to start a medication versus really kind of leaning into these non-medication options?
So when I'll start with the meds part. So I'm a psychiatrist. Usually by the time someone comes to me, they're at least considering medication. You know, there definitely are psychiatrists that just practice psychotherapy or do practice psychotherapy in addition. But in our insurance-based structure, most people are doing med management visits as at least some part of what they're doing. So to come to me, you have to at least have it like in the back of your mind in some capacity. It doesn't mean that I'm going to give it to you, but it means that you might not hate the idea, right? So you're going to not have that because that it comes up all the time. So I consider patient preference because meds don't work if you don't take them, right? So I can tell you all you want that like a medication makes sense, but like if you're not ready to do that yet, we might come up with another alternative. If you're like hesitant, I might think about whether there's a PRN or something you could give to sort of start the kind of easily creeping into anxiety management with meds thing. Like I try to get on some plane with them on that. So patient preference is huge for mental health, I think, because placebo or not for some of it, but also just like buy-in really, really matters. I think people will tell you they have 100 side effects too if they really don't want to be on meds. Past history matters. So she said she had anxiety, depression, if she'd ever been treated before. That would be a big thing because you'd say, well, did it work? And did you get like, did you feel better? And if she says yes, like you actually could just put her on the same thing. She just probably came off because she didn't want to be on meds forever. So having that can be a big thing, you know, severity, right? So anxiety is less concrete in severity sometimes for people than depression. Like there's a point at which you know that person is really in a risk to themselves in a way that you're like, you need meds, right? But to me, like anxiety really disrupts people's ability to exist in the workplace and exist in like friends and family interactions. And if their like sleep is affected, if they're not functioning in the way that they used to, like it, you might start having a medication conversation then. You know, her objective measurement would imply that you would have that conversation just based on that, because it's high enough that if she wanted to try it and she wasn't like morally opposed, you would do it. I think family history matters too. Like if her mom was like super anxious and has always been on meds, she might not hate meds, first of all, because she sees her mom on them. But also, you might be able to be like, you know, some of this stuff is genetic in some capacity. Some of it is environmental because of genetics. But, you know, I think you kind of can, that might raise that to my thought process. You know, I want everybody, like if you've come to me for meds, like I want you in therapy. Does that mean that's going to happen? No, for lots of reasons, like barriers to care, cost, ability to actually like get in with a therapist, time, huge. Like you have to go every week for the most part up front. And that's really challenging for people, like cost and access not included in that. But I think, you know, most of the studies would say like therapy plus meds are better than either alone. There's a reason for that. I can't drug your thoughts out of you. I can make you feel better to tolerate them. I can make you sleep. I can make you like maybe not feel so on edge all the time. But if you have those thoughts, they're still there. If something in particular is triggering you, like a fear or a situation, I can't drug that out of you either. You know, I see a lot of healthcare workers and, you know, they want a med so they can just go back to work and they don't want to talk about their feelings. And it's like a very different group because, you know, there's a lot of just medication hesitancy and mental health to begin with, but healthcare workers are sort of like, just give me the thing and like, let me go back to work. So, you know, I think I would always recommend therapy with the caveat of all the barriers. I don't get mad at people if they don't go, but if we've tried a lot of meds and nothing's working, that's probably why. So at a certain point, like you kind of have to just be like, well, that's the problem. Like that's the missing thing. It feels stressful. It feels time consuming. It feels like woo-woo sometimes, but it actually makes a big difference. You know, evidence-based wise, cognitive behavioral therapy is probably has the most evidence in anxiety, but it's hard to study all other forms of therapy. They're not manualized in a way that you can do a randomized control trial. So you're not going to see, so I like open-ended sort of psychodynamic psychotherapy personally. And, you know, that's, I go to a therapist that does that or sort of a mix of that. And I think if I was like listening to evidence, I might say that's not good because there's no evidence that works. But again, they're very individual. Like the person is the tool. So if you have fit and get along with your therapist, it could work just as much as cognitive behavioral therapy. Some people just don't want to do cognitive behavioral therapy either because it's work, like homework work and like skill practice work. Like it's more like school sometimes than therapy. Yeah. And like, that's not fun. So like some people just don't want to do that. Right. And like, it doesn't work if you don't do it. So, you know, keeping that in mind, if you say to someone like the evidence says this, or like, you know, you might consider this kind of therapy, you also might say, but keep in mind, you're going to get homework. They're going to go over skills specifically with you and it might feel frustrating, but it's really good for you. You know, like having this sort of like awareness that they're going to eye roll for a while about some of this stuff.
Yeah, Jesse, one of the articles I was reading mentioned that CBT has, quote, considerable homework. And it usually is, it's something like 8 to 20 sessions that people go to for it. So I was going to ask, like, we don't have to mention brands here, but like there's a couple different online or, all online, all remote, like services that you can sign up for. I know some health systems even like provide them for their employees and you can get a therapist there. Yeah. It's almost like Uber for therapy. Like you just like, you know, you throw a line out there and there's a bunch of therapists that like are around that you could choose from. So what do you think about those resources or just like online self-directed CBT? Are those things that you've seen anyone have success with?
So let's start with the therapy kind of companies. It is important that people can get anything quickly. I'm never going to tell you that's bad and at a price point that they can afford. I think that is huge, especially because on a good day, a medicine I give you is going to take 6 to 8 weeks, right?
Yeah.
That's a long time to wait? And then if you're also on a wait list for psychotherapy, like, what are you doing, right? Like, you ask, like, how to give people stuff. But even if you are working with them and having them come back and trying to, like, kind of patch it while they're waiting, it's really just patching it. You're not their therapist. So access-wise, it's great. I think it comes with a caveat around quality. So I think even the people who are therapists who might moonlight for some of these places would tell you that too, that it's very hit or miss in the therapy, like who is good. They're underpaid and overworked. So to want that job is a specific kind of person sometimes. You might be a person who only wants to see a PhD, and the chances that you're going to get that on one of these apps is probably almost zero. So that's a training thing, right? So again, as a healthcare worker, sometimes people want the 6 years of somebody doing the training as opposed to the 1 to 2 or something like that. So I think that's a decision you might make. Honestly, I tell people they exist and that they can use them, but that I prefer they use them as a bridge. Mm-hmm. Like that they use them while they're waiting for whoever they want to see in the community for the long term, that they use it for short-term, quick access, that they ask for a different one if they hate the person or they're really bad. You know, I've had patients say that the therapists on some of them bring up things that they shouldn't, like religion or politics and, you know, like things that are just really wrong. Like if that happens and you're really uncomfortable, you don't feel safe, like I hope it doesn't scare you away from getting help, but I hope you know that you can ask to see someone else, you know? So mm-hmm. I usually would say stuff like that. Like, but it's very hard to poo-poo an entire thing that makes somebody get in that quickly. But, you know, they are, after all, businesses, and people in mental health are vulnerable. People struggling with their mental health are vulnerable, meaning that you want an answer and you want an answer quickly and you want help and you want help quickly, and the system isn't built that way and you're not getting a lot of support. And so you're like, well, what can I do and what can I do quickly? And that's how, like, all these kind of, I don't know, not scientific ways of helping your mental health kind of get chosen. That's how these kind of companies thrive. That's how some of them that actually were psychiatrists just gave drugs to everybody. You know, I think it's a very, very vulnerable population for, like, the search for answers and answers that don't take years. And it makes me sad a little bit that it's such a hot market for this stuff.
This episode is brought to you by Allbirds. Folks, if you're anything like me, you've spent the winter cursing the cold, maybe exercising less, maybe not eating as well as you would like. But now as spring is coming, I'm thinking about redefining myself, re-engaging with the world, and thinking about what I'm going to do and where I'm going to go. And warmer temperatures also mean new super light styles from Allbirds. Meet the Super Light Collection, Allbirds' lightest ever shoes, now in fresh colors. A lighter than air feel and barely there fit make some of these the most packable styles ever. What can you do in a super light shoe? The better question is, what can't you do? And because they are so packable, the real question is, where are you taking them? Allbirds were nice enough to send me a pair of sneakers. I have to say, they look fantastic and they feel even better. You barely feel like you're wearing anything at all. They're comfy right out of the box. They're great for hiking, for walking, for running, for your day-to-day wear. I've really enjoyed having them. And I will say that now Allbirds is featuring the Super Light Tree Runner, their most breathable lightweight style yet. It is made with ultralight foam, so it's super comfy and packable, which means you can hit the road with less baggage. They have a light-as-air feel and the lowest carbon footprint yet to support every step all day and all night. They're made from a cushy, lightweight foam, and they have extra outsole traction to give you the grip to go for it. They also feature breathable eucalyptus fiber and comfy midsole for all-day adventures. Experience how Allbirds redefines comfort. Visit allbirds.com and use the code CURB for a free pair of socks with a purchase of $48 or more. That's allbirds.com/CURB.
I agree with you. The appeal there is the ease of getting into care. That's the issue. It is very hard to get people in to see a therapist as a primary care, at least in all the places I've worked so far. So, and building that, like, you know, that relationship you always see on movies and TV where the person's had like the same therapist for like 5, 10, 20 years, that like that's super rare in my experience as a primary care.
So Jesse, let's say Sophie does all the stuff. She's doing things that she enjoys. She's practicing relaxation techniques. She's followed recommendations as much as she's been able to, and yet still continues to feel anxious. And so at this point she says, I think I'm ready to try medication to kind of further help my symptoms. What kind of considerations do you think about when you're actually starting an initial agent? Like, how do you choose for her?
Yeah, it's a good question. And I think it has an imperfect answer. And I think that actually frustrates patients a lot, because I don't think we have a very good algorithm or medication in psychiatry. So when I'm thinking about it, I definitely just have meds that we almost always start with an SSRI. Let me just say that. Just again, it's an algorithmic thing. Probably 20 years ago, they started with tricyclics. Then SSRIs made it easier, right? They're just less side effects. So that's what happened to them being the ones you start with. So, you know, I have preferred ones based on patients and seeing them and seeing what people tend to like. And that's some of my thought process. Some of it is, again, like if you have a family member on something, there's a chance it works in you too. So you might as well, right? If a friend's on something and you're really into it because that friend told you it was really helpful, I'm also okay maybe starting that med because you might take it. Side effects come into to thought here too. So sertraline sometimes is worse on your stomach. Depending on who you ask, you might have some more activation on some versus others. Some people might argue that something like escitalopram will make them hungrier. You know, it's very varied, but sometimes like if a person's main concern is that they're awake, like I might be more thoughtful about one. Or if somebody has Crohn's, I might not give them something that is known to have more diarrhea up front, right? So that comes into thought. I will also say that I sometimes deviate from starting with an SSRI and sometimes have given probably like the most no-no of all medicines up front, which is bupropion. And that is because I think that it has a bad reputation. So I actually have seen it be activating in some people and worsen their anxiety. But I also see a population that doesn't want to gain weight and doesn't want sexual side effects. And sometimes the risk that their anxiety gets worse, when you weigh it against those things, they don't care. They're like, give it to me. If it makes me worse, I'll stop it and try one of the ones you say I have to try. So I use it a lot as a first agent, and that is not what anyone would teach you. And it also goes against this sort of like bupropion is the devil for anxiety mindset. But I actually think it helps on a lot of people, especially this sort of comorbid anxiety depression folks. Mm. And if you're going to be so mad about weight gain or sexual side effects that you won't take it, you know, your patients are grownups. It's a risk benefit conversation. And the risk is, you know, it might be a couple weeks of feeling uncomfortable. It depends on when they stop. Mm-hmm. Right. So I have done that before. Which I'm sure is a big, big no-no to someone.
I for a second, the relief that washed over me, because I thought you were going to take a left-hand turn and be like, and I start them with alprazolam, and I was just ready to be heartbroken. So when you said bupropion, I was like, oh, okay. Well,
that sounds fine. And yeah. Jesse, I was reading that it's a good idea to just start lower doses of medications because people with anxiety disorders just more likely to be anxious about taking something and to develop side effects. Is that something you do?
Yeah. So SSRIs like have the risk of increasing anxiety, which just like increasing suicidality is very hard for people to understand because you're treating the thing and you have the chance of making the thing worse, right? But they both exist. And so, you know, I just kind of am like, it's weird, but this is also possible and it's about tolerability. It should go away. And if it doesn't, that's a problem. But I will usually start like half the starting dose for like a week, week and a half, because usually you get more anxiety right away. And if it's really bad, it would be really bad. And then I have them go up to starting. I don't rush up as fast either, probably for the same reasons. I mean, it might be better. I would be like, well, here, it could make your anxiety worse if we go up, or it could make you feel better. Like, do you want to hang out and see if you get better in another couple weeks, right? Like, I might give it more time. But yeah, the data, like studies on anxiety have lower doses versus something like OCD, which higher, which is confusing because they're also friends. Like people, OCD is like a different form of an anxiety, you know, in a lot of people. So it's funny, or, you know, not funny, but like polar opposite.
So if I'm hearing you, you might give escitalopram 5 milligrams and tell them to take half of that for the first week, and then they could go up to 5 milligrams after a week or so if it's going okay. Or sertraline 25, they would take half of that, and, you know, if it's going okay, they would go up something.
So that's hard because those are both like really small doses, really no small matter doses. What, right? So I think I would probably say like 5 is actually the half for my experience, but I wouldn't go 5 to 10. I'd go 5 to 7.5. I would give that as an option. Some people are like, just, I don't want to cut a pill, just give it to me either, right? Yeah. But I would maybe not jump that quickly to 10. In the 25 question, those pills are also super cuttable and come in all the different things. So that can also be nice. But I would probably start with 25 and then go to 50. Like, that's still low. Most people are going to end up at 100 or more probably on that. Mm-hmm. Anxiety.
If you push the dose too quickly, does that manifest? Does the patient come back and tell you, I had increased anxiety, or does it manifest as treatment not efficacy? Does that make sense?
Both.
Like, now I'm starting to worry if I've like increased the dose too quickly and just didn't give them time to actually acclimate and become less anxious. Is that a possibility?
Possible, because it takes a long time, right? So the hard thing is it takes a long time and none of us have time. And a patient who's anxious is going to call a lot and they're going to say, I'm not better. What's wrong? And you're going to want to do something, right? And the same thing if they come to a visit, like you're not going to be like, oh, cool. Like, let's just hang out there, right? So it's hard. And it's why an inpatient, you know, if you remember inpatient psychiatry at all, like they rush that stuff up so quickly. And then they come outpatient and I'm like, I don't think you need to. I mean, I think we should go down on some of this stuff, right? Like, because I'm not even sure that it, like, you need this much medication. So, you know, in an ideal world, you would give it time. In a actual world, it might not happen because you might feel like you need to do something and it might be the best option. But I would just say that it's not perfectly linear. That if you had a side effect before, you're going to get it again when you increase the dose, just like on any medicine, but the risk is there again. So, you know, it's a good conversation with the patient where you just say, like, there's a chance if I increase your medicine that you might feel bad. So, you know, that's just something to know, but I'm happy to do it to see if it makes a difference. But I definitely think that we probably increase too fast and like not everybody needs to be on that, but it's not humanly possible to not, for the most part. Like, if you looked at studies, they're waiting. Like, they're waiting and giving it like a full 8 weeks or whatever. Like, it's just not feasible in a clinical setting, really, where that's not your parameters, to just do nothing for somebody. Like, if your tool is medicine. So you are going to push it up fast. And I wouldn't really be worried about that as much as like, you're just aware that side effects can happen and people might feel more anxious and that maybe you have to go back down, which I've had to do, and maybe go slower. Like if you went 25 to 50 and they were like really anxious, you might try the middle, you know, like something like that, instead of like completely getting rid of the drug entirely. I also think people don't max out meds as much as they should. You know, like, I think we switch a lot. Like, I think we're like the same reason, like you need something to do. And like the person's already at like a decent dose and you're like, well, is this a failure or not? And I think that's a really hard question to answer, and that we probably switch meds more than most. But like when I get someone's med list and they've been on like 15 meds, I try things they've been on before. Because as long as it didn't give them hives and it didn't make them so miserable that they won't take it, I can't be certain that they gave it a good go.
Mm-hmm. So I want to give you another common scenario with this is if someone sounds like they have generalized anxiety, but they're also having episodes of panic, I try not to prescribe benzos. And one of the articles I was reading said, if you are going to prescribe benzos, you should prescribe them in a fixed dose and tell the patient you're going to stop them after 2 or 4 weeks. You shouldn't prescribe them as needed. And I was a little bit like, that's a little counterintuitive to me because usually I give it and I'm like, don't use it unless you're having like a panic attack. What do you think about benzos along with this? Or do you use hydroxyzine as needed? I've seen some people do that.
Sure. So there are many reasons to not use benzos in people, including their past history. So that has to come into your thought process, of course. But I do think that benzos are the psychiatric equivalent of opiates, which is that we've basically been like, ah, benzos, don't give anybody benzos. And so we don't. But some people need benzos because meds take 6 to 8 weeks to work on a good day. And if you're having panic all the time, you're miserable. And whether you take it as needed or you take it scheduled, I think is a frequency question. So if you're having a panic attack every day, you should take it at least once a day for a bit while it kind of settles and try to get yourself to settle. But you have to know that like if you took it consistently, you're going to have to taper it because even on like tiny doses, and attending told me this before, like even on tiny doses, if you were consistently taking a tiny dose of like clonazepam or something, you're more likely to seize even if the dose is small because you're taking it consistently if they just pulled it off. And so it's just something to be mindful of. You know, I'll tell patients like, you know, you're having a lot of panic. I think you probably need to take something every day, but this is not a long-term everyday med. This is the until we figure out what the other thing is med, and we're going to taper you off of it eventually. And that's the goal. Like, I'm not planning on you being on this for a long time. I think in some people though, if the frequency was like 3 times a week, I would probably say take it as needed, but use it as a benchmark for how you're doing. So as needed meds are fantastic measurement tools, right? If you're taking an as needed med every day, you need a daily med. So like I have patients who want to start with as needed meds and I say, if that's all you'll take, I won't start clonazepam probably in those situations. But I will say like if that only thing that you'll take is an as-needed medicine, that's fine. But we have to use it as a barometer for how you're doing. And if you take it every day, we're having this conversation again, you know. But in most people, it's a severity thing for me whether I offer that up front or not. So if you're really, 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 really sick and you don't have like a logical, in my head, counterindication beyond like long-term use of this being a problem, I would probably offer it, but I would monitor it and take people off of it and have that conversation up front. It can be sedating though. The weird thing about benzos, I think, is like some of my patients take them and then take a test and some of my patients take them and go to sleep. And sometimes that's the same patient. And I don't understand that at all. Yeah. So it's just something to keep in mind. I think my favorite drug for as needed anxiety though is propranolol. I probably give it like candy. And I think it's because, so most anxiety meds that are as needed are sedating. And most people can't just sleep all the time. Most of the time when you need to take an as needed med, it's like a work meeting, a test, like whatever is the problem, you cannot be asleep. And a lot of times it's like that physical reaction that's the problem. Like people can tolerate their thoughts. And propranolol is awesome at the physical reaction. Obviously, biggest risk being dizziness. And if you have low blood pressure, something to begin with, but we're using like 10 milligrams. Like we're not using big doses. So if you think about it, like that's a tiny baby medicine and it can really help and isn't sedating. It doesn't have a risk for tolerance. People take it in much higher doses every single day. Like, so I have no qualms telling someone to take it every day. I'm like, okay, so well, you take it every day.
I can get on board with this, Paul.
It's funny. This just came up very recently with a patient of mine who they had efficacy with the propranolol. It actually helped with their physical symptoms, but they said that their doctor stopped it because it wasn't getting at the root cause of their anxiety. I'm like, I'm not sure I understand. I feel like so much of anxiety is the symptoms part, but maybe I was misunderstanding sort of the thought process behind it. But yeah, it's something I've been thinking more about recently as a possible adjunct to bed, but not something I've been using in the past.
I think like because of the patient population I see, it was like, oh, they have data in test-taking anxiety and performance anxiety, et cetera. And I was like, that's basically that on steroids, right? Like that's what I'm seeing so much of. And like, I don't want everybody to be on a benzo for lots of reasons. I'm not like, oh my God, benzos, because I think that's not helpful either. And I think some people need them. And I think that that mentality doesn't help patients, especially if they've been on them before. But propranolol is a nice alternative. I mean, in my mind, that also all other alternatives would be something like hydroxyzine, but keeping in mind, it's really sedating. I usually ask people what Benadryl does to them and have a conversation around that. Like, yes, it's different, but I guess I shouldn't diphenhydramine does to them. But, you know, if they feel like it, you know, they have that weird reaction where they get really activated, that's not helpful. And if they feel like they can sleep for 80 hours, that's not helpful either. So I tend to steer clear of hydroxyzine in those situations. I use buspirone sometimes. If you look at an insert, it is not an as-needed medicine, but some people would like to take it as needed, and that's fine with me. I try to prescribe it once daily and once as needed, and use the once as needed as a measurement for severity. Because people don't like twice a day meds. It is a twice a day med. It is a three times a day med sometimes, but they do not like that. So sometimes if I'm like, you know, someone's not quite ready to be on an SSRI, that can be an option, which is to say, okay, well, there's this like sort of in-between med where you have to take something every day, but it doesn't have the same side effects. You might just like it. But I also describe buspirone as either someone thinks it's the best thing that was ever invented and that was their answer to everything, or it does absolutely nothing. There's no in between. I have no idea why, but it is not a spectrum. Like, it is like, that was the best thing. Why did no one give that to me before? Or why are you giving me Tic Tacs? Like, there's literally nothing in between. And so that doesn't scare me from taking it or, like, you know, having people take it, but I will say that. And I will say we will know very quickly if this does absolutely nothing. And there's a chance it does absolutely nothing, but it sometimes really works for people. And I'm trying not to like take that opportunity away from you if you want it. And then probably the last one on my like probable list would be something like gabapentin. Again, with sedation being big. But, you know, you can start at 100. And what's the max is like 3,600, like something bonkers. So the space there is like astronomical for some of these concerns that people have around gabapentin.
And with buspirone, are you typically using that with an SSRI or using that as sort of monotherapy if the SSRI is not effective for the patient, or just kind of depends? Like what are the contexts where you're using buspirone? Because I feel like that's the one, you know, Dr. UpToDate, whom I trust in all things, who haven't sponsored us yet. I feel like that's sort of their recommended sort of next step in therapy, but I'm never quite sure how to use it in combination with the other medications.
So my most go-to use of it is these people who don't want meds yet. It's a good option for people who don't want meds yet. It's like a test of them taking something, and it doesn't look as bad if they Google it. In fact, there's like no information really if they Google it. And so for the most part, that's helpful. And so I'll be like, well, here's an in-between, and it's not as needed. So you're not chasing it as much, you know, if you have them take it that way. As an adjunct, like to an SSRI, I would say it's only helpful if you are mostly there and you don't want to change the med. Like if somebody's on almost a max dose of something, or and they really like what they're on, they just have like a little bit left that they would like a little help with, then I might try something like that because it's easier than switching and it's probably lower risk than adding another antidepressant or something as an augmenter.
Jesse, so to bring it back to our case, let's say Sophie, we're starting her with a GAD-7 score of 15 and we put her on sertraline. She took 25 for a week or two. Then she went to 50. We talked to her on the phone like a month in and she wanted to try to go up. So let's say we're at 8 weeks and she's on 100 and her score is down to like 8, but she's still not functioning as well as she would want. Is that like the kind of situation where you're saying like gabapentin or buspirone, the you would potentially give them that and give them a couple dose, like they could take up to 2 doses a day or up to 3 doses a day of either of those, something like that?
Yeah, I would say if you know, Sophie said, like, I kind of like it and I feel a bit better, but I'm not perfect. And I, you know, not that anyone ever is, but like, I still am pretty anxious and it's still interfering with my life. The question would be how bad and if you should go up above 100, right? That would be your mm-hmm. first thing. But if it's like, I don't want to do that, like, I am good with this. Is there anything else I can do? Or like, you feel like you don't need to do that part, you know, then I might add it. In that circumstance, you know, something like gabapentin, if like the problem is that she feels great, but she's not sleeping, it's solving two things. So would something like hydroxyzine, right? Like it's helping with both, like it's anxious mm-hmm. thoughts at night, usually, you know, in that circumstance that you're just putting them to bed. So, mm-hmm. you know, I think the in those circumstances, like adding something like that can be helpful because you're mm-hmm. like kind of, you know, for lack of a less bad metaphor, killing two birds with one stone. But I think you're sort of like trying to say like, okay, what are the symptoms that are left that are really interfering? And if you can target that with something else, you might. Mm-hmm. That's why you might sometimes see someone with anxiety who's on like a sleeper and an as needed. Cause it's like people are trying to kind of put it all together in a way that's helpful for them.
So this is a little bit out of order, but I wonder what the thinking is with SNRIs for anxiety. Like for depression, I will usually reach for them if there's some sort of possible secondary benefit, like vasomotor symptoms of menopause, or if there's some sort of chronic neuropathic pain, like then I might be like, why don't we try this and see if we can't sort of attack both? Is there a role for SNRIs with anxiety or a reason that you would reach for them versus an SSRI's initial therapy or switch to them perhaps?
Same reasons for initial. You know, if somebody was like having migraines, I might do the same with like a TCA, you know, so I do still think like that, even though there probably isn't as good of robust evidence in anxiety for thinking like that. You know, there's a lot of sort of chronic pain overlap with depression and a concern and need to treat that, right? And so there's been a lot of studies on it, but it's not to say those people aren't anxious too. So, you know, it will come up in certain situations where it makes sense like that for me. But most of the time it would be 1 to 2 SSRI choices. And then at that point, if I sort of was like, like I would look at bupropion and I would look at an SNRI, especially if it wasn't like they partially were working and I'm like wanting to add an adjunct. It's like, they're just not working. Because, you know, I think the caveat on all SNRIs is the coming off of it is horrible and skipping doses is horrible, especially for venlafaxine. Venlafaxine is the worst for that. And so, you know, I always give that caveat. Like, I'm going to try a different class of meds, but there's a chance if you skip a dose, you might feel miserable.
Even the extended release.
That med is hard to come off of if you've ever tapered someone. You know, rule of thumb, I might go down every 2 weeks or something if I can, if people can tolerate it. But sometimes that one needs a little extra. Sometimes I've had to use a benzo in those circumstances, like trying to come off a med just as much as coming on.
So it sounds like part of what we got to with Paul's questions was if someone had no response to like 1 or 2 SSRIs or an SNRI, then what would you do then? You know, like if we've tried some of the first line agents, then are you going to TCAs as like, or are you going to antipsychotics? You mentioned aripiprazole or quetiapine I've seen listed, mm-hmm. risperidone. Some of the articles I was reading said like, if you get to that point, then they should be seeing a psychiatrist because side effects can be much worse with those meds. And
yeah, I mean, I wouldn't assume that you guys would be like throwing antipsychotics at people just because there's just a lot of side effects inherently with them and it's complicated. I have used quetiapine in a similar like sleep being the main thing mm-hmm. situation, but 25 to 50, we're not talking
like 200. Yeah.
You know, I think if you're feeling like you're just adding meds or just throwing darts, they should probably see a psychiatrist, because at least if we're throwing darts, we've thrown them a bunch, you know? It's imperfect and we might still be throwing darts, but inherently, like, we've probably seen more people like that, and that dart worked, or that one to the middle, right? So I think that if you're feeling like that, you know, it's not to say if you feel super comfortable that you don't do something like that, you know, but I do think that it's probably, outside of saying that someone should go to therapy or something, what you're going to end up having to do in those situations, because it's not like you even have the capacity to keep being like, okay, let's try something else. Like, okay, let's try something else. And it's really frustrating sometimes. There are very expensive genetic tests that sometimes people will request because they've heard of them. They're correlations, not causations, and they are imperfect too. It's like a percentage, you know, but sometimes in someone with anxiety, it like helps you make an argument for switching or another med or something, right? So sometimes it just gives them something to lay their hat on. Like I describe it like, it's expensive. You're not probably getting that covered. It's not really that helpful, but if it would help you to have a list and go off that list based on what the test said, more power to you. I'll go off the list. So sometimes that can help.
This test is looking at how they might metabolize certain drugs, and you might respond better to this one than that one. I actually have come across this, and after kind of looking at it, looking it up and discussing with the patient, they decided not to go through it. Basically because of what you said, but I could see how in the right person, if they just want to know and it's not cost prohibitive for them, then it might help them do better with the medication if they know physiologically, like they're more likely to benefit from it.
Yeah, it can be a double-edged sword, of course. Like if you give them that knowledge and then you're like, we're out of the green ones. Can we go to yellow? Right? Because it's like a stoplight. And, you know, they might get a little bit mad, but, you know, I think it can help if you're feeling sort of like spinny with somebody. Yeah. But they are not, I mean, you know, they're out of pocket, not that cheap. And so that's kind of hard.
Okay.
Before we get the more exotic stuff, I feel like, you know, disordered sleep can be so much part of anxiety and depression too. And I don't see folks reaching for mirtazapine so much for anxiety specifically. And what's the thought about that in terms of when to use it or to use it at all?
So weight gain is real. For that, it is not a good long-term drug in most people, because sometime in our life, our weight catches up to us, or sometime in our life, our weight is already a problem, right? So it can be hard. If people are fine with that, it's not a bad option at all, especially if they want help quicker. So in the hospital, you use mirtazapine a lot on like consult psychiatry, because it works really fast and it has like no drug interactions. So if you're on like oncology and someone's on like a bunch of serotonergic drugs, because like a lot of those meds are, and you're just trying to kind of help, it helps pretty quickly, especially with sleep and anxiety. And it doesn't interact with a lot. So it can be really good in people like that. I think older people, skinny older people who aren't eating anyway. Yeah. So that's the other way our bodies can go. So they're fine being on something like that, and it might help quicker, and it can be great. You know, like it's fine if they're a little hungry. I see college kids who will like murder me in my sleep if I make them gain weight. So it's not a early choice for me just for those reasons. But I worked psych-onc for a while. It was like my only option. So I think, you know, it definitely can be helpful. The important thing with mirtazapine is just to remember the dosing is super weird. And at low doses, it is more sedating than at higher doses. So it has to do with like when it hits certain receptors and histamines, like lower doses, but that's super strange to patients. So like, you know, like a 30 is actually probably like in the middle, right? So you kind of need to, you sometimes start there because you're like, I don't know if I need to go up or down. So, but it doesn't really make sense that that's the case. So that's just something weird that you probably remember from like a test if you've never used it before, but like that is true about that particular medication.
Is the weight gain a problem at all doses though? Yeah. Okay. I thought so.
It's like hunger. Again, you can also say to people, if you don't feel more hungry, that's fine, right? Like you can track it. If you feel comfortable tracking that, that's fine. But mm-hmm. it's sort of like, I wouldn't say it's as bad as steroids, but it's like, it has a similar thing. Like people eat at night and they just don't get full on like their meals, and then they're snacking and they don't realize it. And then they gain a lot of weight, just like on steroids.
Matt, did I tell you this, that my cat is on mirtazapine? Are you aware of this? It's transdermal. And this, the part I shouldn't share is that the vet's office, I'm like, do I just put on, like, should I be using a glove or whatever? And they're like, you can just wash your hands, I guess. I was like, I don't know. Maybe they're picking up a vibe for me. I'm not really sure. But yeah, so it's being used for appetite for my older cat. So fun side note about mirtazapine. Apparently vets like it.
They like trazodone too. But
and gabapentin and buprenorphine too.
All right. I know we're sort of coming to the end here of the, because we've got to let you get to the rest of your night at some point. So let's say we go back to the beginning. Sophie read in the news that SSRIs don't work, that this theory about how serotonin agents work was incorrect. So how do you address that? Have you come across this? Because this was in the popular press in 2023 that, like, oh my God, I had people say, oh my gosh, I heard SSRIs don't even work. It was a total sham.
Yes, I have come across it. It gives you a really good opportunity to explain scientific misinformation and how to digest what people are reading. So, like, you know, they're not necessarily ever going to go to the original paper. If you go to that original paper, not only will you find out that the people who wrote it hate medication, if you look at all of them, but you'll also note that the paper is just saying that it's not just serotonin, but it never once says meds don't work, because that's not the point of the paper. The point is to say it's not just serotonin. But if you ask a psychiatrist, it's like, duh, because SNRIs aren't just serotonin. Mirtazapine isn't, you know, serotonin. Bupropion isn't just serotonin. Like, we've always known depression is more complex than that. It's a very simplistic view to assume that the only reason we are not happy is serotonin. It is a part of it, but it is not the only thing. And I think with SSRIs in particular, like, they probably do more on precursors and things like that than we can, you know, really, really know. But I think when I talk to patients about it, it's like, let's talk about how articles and headlines come from something that is not what it says. And let's talk about how that's just kind of how science gets conveyed and where the problems with that are. And then I will say things like what I just said about how we've kind of always known it's more complicated than that. But that, you know, what it tells us is that sometimes people need different meds, but sometimes SSRIs still work, right? So it wasn't studying that at all. And we have data that SSRIs work, right? Mm-hmm. And like, it doesn't negate that, because they made some claim about actual kind of gathering of data that says that about serotonin, you know? So I think it's important that we don't make leaps like that to say, like, not just serotonin equals meds don't work. because that's not what they studied, and that's not what they even said, even though they don't like meds. So, I think it's really important that you have that conversation. I'm a big believer, like, so tons of, like, all of us have to deal with this, but TikTok in particular has a lot of, like, mental health conversations that, like, encourage people to come in with diagnoses. And I'm a big believer of, like, wherever you get your information, it's still information, and at least you looked it up, and at least you're interested in yourself, and at least you care. So instead of going, no, that's a stupid thing, that's not true, I would be like, well, where did you read it? Like, what makes you worried about that? And like, how can I help explain that in a way that would make you feel better about it? If you came in with a diagnosis and were sure you had it, I would say, well, what about that resonated? And then I would say, don't hate me, but concentration is more complicated than ADHD. Can we talk about that without you hating me?
All right. Well, thank you for saying that. I felt like we had to address it, just since it was, like, so, at least in the news in 2023. All right. So, Paul, any last things that you wanted to ask about? And we'll check in with Eddie as well. But Paul, anything else on your wish list for this?
You know I'm going to ask about cannabis, because it's my favorite topic.
Oh, that's right. I forgot.
I couldn't let you go without this. And I'm not certainly not asking for treatment recommendations. I think in Pennsylvania, it's actually one of the certifying conditions where we have medical cannabis, at least, which I, and the data seems sort of dubious to me, but I guess my question to you is sort of, how do you counsel patients who are using cannabis to sort of self-medicate for anxiety or the insomnia that comes along with it? Is that something that we endorse? Is it just something we acknowledge? Or is there other counseling that goes for patients who come to us with that?
Yeah. Cannabis for mental health reasons is, there's no good evidence. In fact, it would probably, if any evidence exists, it's the other way. I don't write medical marijuana cards for that reason, because I just don't even want to bother. Like, I just am, for the most part, more afraid that someone will become psychotic than I am, or like, you know, something else will happen, than I am that, you know, it's going to have an amazing effect on their anxiety, because I've seen the psychosis more. And so I actually won't do it. But, you know, they are marketed as anxiety medications. If you go into a shop, they will say, like, this strand is really good for anxiety because it has like blah, 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 blah. And so usually what I'll say is, like, see how serious it is that they take that. Like, if there's any chance I can get that to not be included, I will try and say things like, there's no evidence on like its interactions with medication. It would be really awesome if we didn't have to take both right now, just to make sure we figure out what works. And there's nothing like making it more complicated. But if that's like a deal breaker, I will tell them that rebound anxiety is a thing. And that they need to just like rebound insomnia with that stuff, and that they need to pay attention that, like, even if they might feel better in the moment, that there's a very good chance that they won't later, and then it'll tell them to take more. And so they just need to like pay attention to that, and also be aware that like their mood can be affected, and that they could like have other issues as it relates to their mental health when it comes to taking those strands, and that is something to keep in mind. I'll try to do like motivational interviewing around it and like get a cut down if I can. I have also agreed to one specific strand from one specific store and only that, which was like where we got. But I actually think that probably was harm reduction, just because in the grand scheme of things, like, who knows what's in all, like, these are like, they're not really like made like meds are, right? So, you know, I say that to them too, but I'm like, listen, like, I don't know how to keep, like, you took this one, it did this, you took this one, it did this. Like, if we're going to play that game, I'm not switching your meds all the time. So can you just like kind of consistently get the same thing?
Oh, okay.
I see a lot of young kids, they're going to smoke, they're going to drink. Like, nobody's going to listen to me telling them like no, but they will listen to like some of the risks sometimes, and they will listen to you being like, listen, I'm not trying to like be your mom, I'm not trying to be annoying about this, it's just that like it also does stuff in your brain, and I'm also doing stuff in your brain, and I'm worried that I'm gonna mess something up. And like, it would be very helpful to me if you just kind of took that out of the equation. But, you know, it's hard to do in a lot of ways. You know, with drinking on meds, it comes up a lot too, because the bottle says don't do it. But I talk about tolerance really with them, because I do think their tolerance is affected. It doesn't, again, a pharmaceutical company might disagree with me. I don't think it makes it not work, and it doesn't make alcohol stronger, but it does somehow make it so like you might have been a 4-drink person and you're a 1-drink person. So I do think that, like, I'll say when you first drink on a medication, please like drink less and wait and see how you feel, so that you don't like miss a whole day. Because I just, again, if I could, I could see college students and have them all stop drinking, I would, but it's just no one would ever take a medicine if I had to tell them all to stop drinking. So I'm just very realistic about this stuff, and it probably isn't most people's way of dealing with it. And I think there are probably some psychiatrists, especially, who are like, that stuff affects your brain, none of that, while we're figuring this out. I'm just not that naive. And I would rather have like buy-in from the population that I see. And sometimes that's like being a little bit more real and getting to where you can in a motivational interviewing sense. And like, I had a parent sit in once on something like this when I was having a conversation, and I just like could see the parent's face just kind of being like, I don't know that that's the conversation I would like you to be having with our kid, you know, because it was just like, well, how can we like limit this? And how can we just get, where are you getting it from? And how, you know, and the parent's face was kind of like, well, that's a tactic, you know, like it was just fine because the kid likes me and she, like, they have no say, right? Because they're an adult, but it was just very interesting to me.
Well, yeah, I mean, I feel like we've known this for forever that telling someone about a behavior that might have adverse health consequences, that they should just stop doing that, has worked exactly zero times. Like, that is not, it's not going to work for any of them. So it's, I think partnering with the patient is always a good option.
Yeah.
All right. I think we should move to take home points because, Paul, we could probably go another hour, but 100%. I think that would be cruel to poor Jesse. So
I work psychiatrist hours, folks. Like I probably would be asleep.
All right. So if you had to pick maybe, I don't know, like two or three take home points from this discussion we've had for the audience to remember, what would those be?
Number one, if you don't feel comfortable doing it, ask a psychiatrist. But, you know, sure. Really, if you, I like it when primary care doctors try because it's too hard for everyone to get in to see psychiatry. It's not necessary for everyone to come see psychiatry. And for the most part, there's less stigma seeing you guys. So it's not helpful to just assume everyone who has a mental health condition should see a psychiatrist. But if you start to feel like it's beyond the scope of like what you can do in the time, in your comfort level, like that's when you refer just like you would for any specialty. The second thing being, you know, mental health is like the reason we get like motivational interviewing training and we know how to do therapy is a lot of it's about the person and like getting on their side. And you don't always have time for that, but remember that when you're rushed, which is to say like, try to understand how they use terms, try to understand what brings them in, try to understand what's really troubling them or how they describe it. Try to understand like how they feel about medicine and why they're so hesitant or why it's causing problems because they're not going to take it if they don't talk to you about that stuff. And I know it's really hard to do, but it's really important in mental health, probably like even more than some things. You can kind of think about it as like the way you guys have to talk to people who are taking insulin and stuff and like, you know, struggle with it and, you know, trying to understand that and get on the same page with them is really important. And then the third thing just being like, listen, we're healthcare workers. We have our own mental health stuff. And so I just like want everybody to know that like being anxious is normal. But being anxious so badly that like you can't do what you want to do and it lasts for a really long time is not, right? So it's a spectrum just like anything. And it doesn't need to get to the level where your whole life is affected before you get help. That includes for healthcare workers, but that's the same with your patients. If somebody's in your office and they're mentioning stuff and you might be able to catch it early, that's important because not everybody should get to the point where they have to see me, or not everybody should get to the point where they only notice it's a problem because they're failing at school, right? Like our criteria for mental health challenges is like getting A's or like a job performance evaluation, right? Like my boss says I'm fine. Like I'm still getting A's and you're like, well, what did you do today? And they're like, I haven't left my room in weeks and I eat takeout every single day and I have no friends, right? Like that's, there's a lot to life that's not this objective measurement of success that we have. And so it's important that just because someone says like they're doing well in school or work that we ask about the rest of their life and we make them look at the rest of their life. But we also realize that like you can catch this stuff earlier in primary care than I ever could. And asking about it is really critical. I don't expect, you know, I mean, it might end up in the setting where you like people are going to have to screen just like they have to do depression like all the time. But screening is helpful. Most of the time people see general practitioners much more than they would see a mental health professional. And you have the opportunity to like make it so people don't get that sick by just knowing a little bit more and being a little bit more comfortable with it. And I think that's a really cool power. Like, I wish I had that. I don't have that because people come so much later. But, you know, like, it's a cool power to be like, I actually prevented that person from needing a med, or like I actually only needed to use a baby dose and stop it on someone. Like, that's cool.
Paul's America's primary care physician. So that's like his, that's just like a normal day in the office for him.
Yeah,
totally. Mm-hmm. You can't really do primary care if you hate mental health. same with ER. Like, I love my friends who do all of it, but when they pretend that it's not like half of their job, it's just not fair. Like peds too. So all three of those, anything where you see people right at the first time you can, it is very large amount of mental health. You might prefer trauma, but you're still getting mental health. So, you know, you have to be comfortable enough with it and you have to like it enough to help people because that's what you're seeing.
Did you want to plug anything coming out later this year before we let you go?
Sure. Anytime people want to find me, I'm at Dr. Jessie Gold on like everything. I annoyingly spell it J-E-S-S-I like Jessica without the C-A. So you can blame my childhood self for that. I have a website with the same name where like all my writings and stuff are, you know, sometimes I've had friends say that some of the things that like I've explained in writings have been helpful to give to patients or refer to patients. So that can be a place where if you just want, I do a lot of psychoed on things for like self or in style. And those are places where it's made for not, you know, academic settings. And then I have a book coming out in October. It's called How Do You Feel? It is really about me and my healthcare worker patients and like what it's like to care for other people and not care for ourselves in the meantime, and all of the barriers in sort of our group of people to really focus on themselves and care about themselves, especially their mental health. And that's in October, but hopefully I'll have pre-orders in like the next month or two. And I'm hopeful that like people in your audience will feel like a little seen by it, because that's really the purpose in writing it. And also realize that like, you know, there's caregiving across the board, not just in healthcare. We're just this like horrible microcosm of it. But you know, that other people might understand us a little better if they understood what that's like too.
All right. So everyone in the audience, please buy a copy of the book, check out the website, follow her on social. And thank you so much for all your time and all your teaching tonight. This is great.
Thanks for having me.
This has been another episode of The Curbsiders, bringing you a little knowledge food for your brain hole.
Yummy.
I wasn't sure if you're going to go for it. No, I'm not sure. I'm glad you did. Still hungry for more? Join our Patreon and get all of our episodes ad-free, plus twice monthly bonus episodes at patreon.com/curbsiders. You can find our show notes at thecurbsiders.com and sign up for our mailing list to get our weekly show notes in your inbox, which includes our Curbsiders Digest, which recaps the latest practice-changing articles, guidelines, and news in internal meds.
And we're committed to high-value, practice-changing knowledge. And to do that, we need your feedback. So send an email to askcurbsiders@gmail.com. It also really helps if you subscribe, rate, and review the show on YouTube, Spotify, or Apple Podcasts. And a reminder that this and most episodes are available for CME through VCU Health at curbsiders.vcuhealth.org. Wanted to give a special thanks to our writer and producer for this episode, Edison Eddie Jang, and to our whole Curbsiders team. Our technical production is done by Podpaste. Elizabeth Proto runs our social media. Jen Watto runs our Patreon. Chris the Chew Manchu moderates the Discord. And Stuart Brigham composed our theme music. And with all that, until next time, I've been Dr. Matthew Frank Watto.
I'm Edison Jang.
And as always, I remain Dr. Paul Nelson Williams. Thank you and goodbye.